Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, October 3rd, 2025. We begin on page one, where the main story is about the McLean County Museum of History, and the story is titled Grief and Loss, Part of Our History. Mourning in McLean exhibit explores evolving customs. This story is datelined Bloomington. While discussions of death can spur strong emotions, its traditions and practices have aided in the grieving process for centuries, evolving with technology, culture, and spirituality. Those traditions are on display in downtown Bloomington, captured in the McLean County Museum of History's newest exhibit, Mourning in McLean. The multi-level display features curated artifacts and archival materials exploring the various ways the county's residents have mourned and honored their deceased loved ones. I hope that people come away with maybe being a little less trepidatious about death and having this understanding that it has all come about because people want to remember and honor those who have come before us, said Candace Summers, Senior Director of Education at the McLean County Museum of History. The exhibit, which is available for viewing through November 21st, displays items taken from the museum's extensive collection in an examination of the perceptions of death, ritualistic practices, and customary expressions of grief in central Illinois. It spans from mid-19th century to the early 20th century, with multiple cases on each floor of the museum, Summers said. Having helped organize the Evergreen Cemetery Walk, which had its 30th and final show last fall, Summers said the idea for the Mourning in McLean exhibit was inspired by another display of Victorian funeral customs and other artifacts shown in 2023 at the C.H. Moore Homestead and the DeWitt County Museum in Clinton. Although she never got to see that exhibit on display, Summers said the name Mourning Moore became stuck in her head, and she started thinking of all the objects and items in McLean County's museum that could share a similar story of death and loss. I did not realize how much stuff we had until I started digging around in our collection, and I could have probably filled about four more cases, or this could have truly been a big exhibit, Summers said. There are just so many other fascinating things that help tell the story that I think people would be really interested in seeing. The items on display include post-mortem photographs, jewelry incorporating loved one's hair or teeth, a cooling table used by funeral home directors before embalming became the common practice, mourning ribbons and clothing, memorial cards, and monuments. Summers said this collection illustrates how the need to honor and memorialize the deceased manifested in a multitude of expressions across cultures and time. From simple rituals and intimate family gatherings to elaborate ceremonies steeped in tradition and public displays, these acts of remembrance reflect evolving views on death and mourning, Summers said. One case features a black two-piece funeral dress worn by Esther Gaines Wright of Normal at the funeral of her husband and a three-piece suit worn by Kenneth Curtis of Bellflower, which he wore practically everywhere around town. He would wear it going to town or he would wear it to school functions, Summers said. Little bits and pieces of details about these people's lives and how these objects fit into their lives and how they tell that larger picture of how people mourn the loss of our loved ones here in McLean County. Summers said one thing she noticed when working with students on the cemetery walk was how scared and uncertain they were to be visiting a cemetery. Death and mourning carry a taboo that leaves people not understanding or appreciating the traditions and practices, and the education director said it is important to learn that death is a part of life. It is okay to mourn. It is okay to be sad. It's okay to grieve. It is a natural part of the process. And these are how people did that over time in McLean County, she said. The exhibit will be on display on Friday during downtown Bloomington's First Friday activities from 5 to 8 p.m. and for the museum's Dia de Muertos celebration on November 1st. The museum is also hosting cemetery tours and picnics in connection to the morning exhibit. Saturday's tours are sold out, but those interested in learning more about the topic can attend an illustrated program at 2 p.m. October 18th that will further explore the local history of death practices. The whole tie-in here is making space for people to come, gather, reflect, and remember people, and to find some commonality in our practices, said Michaela Harris, the museum's director of communications. We are not interpreting any links between practices, but there are inherently ones there, and I think that the fall season is always a nice transition to offer these programs and events. And you can visit mchistory.org to learn about the exhibit and other events hosted by the McLean County Museum of History. The exhibit and programs are supported by Pontiac Granite Company, East Lawn Funeral Home and Memorial Gardens, Evergreen Memorial Cemetery, and Kibler Brady Russinen Memorial Home. And this story is accompanied by photographs of some of the items in the exhibit, including a silver-plated coffin plate from the late 1800s, a fan from 1941, and some hair memorials. Our next front page story is about the U.S. government, titled Illinois Will Feel Shutdown Impact, 153,000 Federal Workers Caught in D.C. Deadlock. This is a story from the Chicago Tribune. State leaders say more than 153,000 federal workers in Illinois and their families will feel the immediate impact of the federal government shutdown, while no sign of resolution appeared in sight for lawmakers in Washington. The shutdown began Wednesday after lawmakers deadlocked and missed the deadline for funding the government. Republicans supported a short-term measure to fund the government generally at current levels through November 21st, but Democrats blocked it, insisting the measure address their concerns on health care. They want to reverse the Medicaid cuts in President Donald Trump's package of tax breaks and spending reductions from the summer, and they want to extend tax credits that make health insurance premiums more affordable for millions of people who purchase through the marketplaces established by the Affordable Care Act. Republicans called the Democratic proposal a non-starter that would cost taxpayers more than $1 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office estimates roughly 750,000 federal employees could be furloughed each day of the shutdown, with the total daily cost of their compensation at roughly $400 million. Furloughs are possible for an estimated 45,000 federal employees in Illinois, according to statements from Governor J.B. Pritzker and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Pritzker also said that benefit programs and Illinois' economy would be disrupted by a shutdown. The shutdown comes as Trump has deployed federal agents in Illinois amid a blitz against illegal immigration and also threats that he will send military troops into the city. On Sunday, U.S. Border Patrol agents marched down Michigan Avenue and around downtown Chicago in what many described as a performative attempt at intimidation. Pritzker said Trump's plan to bring military troops into the city won't be hurt by the federal government shutdown. He can do that because there are emergency personnel and military personnel that he can keep on the job, Pritzker said. The militarization will go on while innocent and vulnerable people suffer. In a statement, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, who months ago sided with Republicans to keep the government operating, but on Tuesday voted against the Republican funding bill, said President Trump and congressional Republicans made clear they would rather shut down the government than address their looming, self-inflicted health care crisis. He further said that a nearly $1 trillion cut to Medicaid, which the GOP previously pushed through, will rip away health insurance from approximately 10 million Americans. Republicans are fine with ballooning the national debt to make room for tax cuts for the rich, but draw the line at extending health care to millions of middle-income families, he said. Democrats remain ready, as we have been for months, to come to the table to broker a sensible deal that addresses the Republican health care crisis and ensures the essential functions of government remain running on behalf of the American people, but Republicans have been unwilling to negotiate. During a speech on the Senate floor hours before the government was shut down, Durbin hammered Trump for waiting so long to meet with Democrats to discuss a funding plan. Despite knowing since March that government funding was going to run out tonight, President Donald Trump waited until yesterday, to meet with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Durbin said. What was he waiting for? Think about it, Durbin said. He waited until a day before the government funding deadline to finally sit down and talk to both political parties. Federal employees involved in national defense, law enforcement, and the protection of property and life will continue working, according to a statement by the Office of Personnel Management. How quickly many get paid remains a little cloudy. Employees not paid from appropriated funds and those accepted to administer shutdown operations will continue to work and will almost certainly be paid, though this requires specific congressional approval. All airports, including O'Hare International and Midway, air traffic controllers and agents will continue to work. Those who are not required to work are considered furloughed and will be placed in a non-pay, non-duty status until the shutdown ends, according to the OPM statement. Social Security payments will still go out. In-person service requests, however, may not be addressed during the shutdown. According to the official Social Security website, the office will not be able to provide proof of benefits letters or update or correct earnings records. These in-person services will resume when the federal government is operating normally, the site says. Federal courts will remain open for the time being. The U.S. courts released a statement on Wednesday saying the judiciary branch will remain open despite the shutdown. It planned to shut down October 3rd, but will use court fee balances and funds not reliant on new appropriations to continue paid operations through Friday, October 17th. If the shutdown continues after judiciary funds are exhausted, the court will then operate under the terms of the Anti-Deficiency Act, which allows work to continue during a lapse of appropriations if it is necessary to support the exercises of Article III judicial powers, the statement said. Under this scenario, each court and federal defender's office would determine the staffing resources necessary to support such work. Will the shutdown affect air travel? As noted, airports will remain open and the TSA will continue to operate as usual, but travelers should expect long wait times at checkpoints. U.S. Customs and Border Protection is considered essential and will continue operations. Will my mail still come? Yes, the U.S. Postal Service will continue to deliver mail during a government shutdown, and the post office will continue operating, according to a statement from USPS on September 25th. How will this affect veterans? According to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, benefits will still be processed and delivered, including compensation, housing, and education benefits. Regional offices will be closed during the shutdown, and the department will cease providing transition program assistance and career counseling. How will federal employees be affected? According to the OPM statement, quote, federal employees may be eligible for unemployment compensation for federal employees. This compensation program is administered by state unemployment insurance, UI agencies acting as agents of the federal government. The program is operated under the same terms and conditions that apply to regular state UI. In general, the law of the state in which an individual's official duty station in federal civilian service is located will be the state law under which an individual's eligibility for benefits is determined. And our last front page story is about the Durban Honor. Pope says pro-life more about more than abortion. This is an Associated Press story, datelined Rome. Pope Leo XIV has intervened for the first time in an abortion dispute roiling the U.S. Catholic Church by raising the seeming contradiction over what it really means to be pro-life. Leo, a Chicago native, was asked late Tuesday about plans by Chicago Cardinal Blaise Kupich to give a Lifetime Achievement Award to U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois for his work helping immigrants. The plans drew objection from some conservative U.S. bishops, given the powerful Democratic senator's support for abortion rights. Leo called, first of all, for respect for both sides, but he also pointed out the seeming contradiction in such debates. Someone who says, "I am against abortion," but says, "I am in favor of the death penalty," is not really pro-life, Leo said. Someone who says that I am against abortion, but I am in agreement with the inhuman treatment of immigrants in the United States, I don't know if that's pro-life. Leo, whose words echoed a common Catholic argument often made in discussions about abortion, spoke hours before Kupich announced that Durbin had declined the award. Church teaching forbids abortion, but it also opposes capital punishment as inadmissible under all circumstances. U.S. bishops and the Vatican have strongly called for humane treatment of migrants, citing the biblical command to welcome the stranger. In his comments about the Illinois dispute, Leo made no mention of U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration has carried out a surge of immigration enforcement in the Chicago area. Still, while White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt weighed in and disputed concerns raised by Pope Leo about the treatment of immigrants, saying that she would reject there is inhumane treatment of illegal immigrants in the United States under this administration. The administration, Leavitt said, is trying to enforce our nation's laws in the most humane way possible. Leo said he was not familiar with the details of the dispute over the Durbin Award, but said it was nevertheless important to look at the senator's overall record and noted Durbin's four-decade tenure. Responding to a question in English from the U.S. Catholic broadcaster EWTN News, he said there were many ethical issues that constitute the teaching of the Catholic Church. "I don't know if anyone has all the truth on them, but I would ask first and foremost that there be greater respect for one another and that we search together, both as human beings, in that case as American citizens or citizens of the state of Illinois, as well as Catholics, to say that we need to, you know, really look closely at all of these ethical issues and to find the way forward in this church. Church teaching on each one of these issues is very clear," he said. Kupich was a strong advisor to Pope Francis, who strongly upheld church teaching opposing abortion, but also criticized the politicizing of the abortion debate by U.S. bishops. Some bishops had called for denying communion to Catholic politicians who supported abortion rights, including former President Joe Biden. Biden met on several occasions with Francis and told reporters in 2021 that Francis had told him to continue receiving communion. During a visit to Rome that year, he received the sacrament during Mass at a church in Francis's diocese. Durbin was barred from receiving community in his home diocese of Springfield in 2004. Springfield Bishop Thomas Paprocki has continued the prohibition and was one of the U.S. bishops who strongly objected to Cupich's decision to honor the senator. Cupich claims Durbin as a member of the Chicago Archdiocese, where Durbin also has a home. In his statement announcing that Durbin would decline the award, Cupich lamented that the polarization in the U.S. has created a situation where U.S. Catholics find themselves politically homeless, since neither the Republican nor the Democratic Party fully encapsulates the breadth of Catholic teaching. He defended honoring Durbin for his pro-immigration stance and said the planned November 3rd award ceremony could have been an occasion to engage him and other political leaders with the hope of pressing the church's view on other issues, including abortion. It could be an invitation to Catholics who tirelessly promote the dignity of the unborn, the elderly, and the sick to extend the circle of protection to immigrants facing in this present moment an existential threat to their lives and the lives of their families, Cupich wrote. Paprocki, for his part, thanked Durbin for declining the award. I ask that all Catholics continue to pray for our church, our country, and for the human dignity of all people to be respected in all stages of life, including the unborn and immigrants, Paprocki said in a Facebook post. And we move now to some local and state news. This story is headlined, "Abel Leaving McLean County Board, Dateline Normal." McLean County Board member Crystal Abel announced her resignation during a town hall event Wednesday evening, driven by her plans to move out of her district. Abel said she has notified McLean County Board Chair Elizabeth Johnston she will be stepping down the day after the board's November meeting, which will include a vote to approve McLean County's fiscal 2026 proposed budget. Johnston said under board rules, the application process to fill Abel's seat cannot begin until her seat is vacated. This is likely to begin on November 17th. Applicants must be a part of the Democratic Party and live in the county's 4th district, which covers the northwest portion of Normal. She has been an asset, working well with property committee and making sure we are taking care of employees, Johnston said. I am grateful for her service, and I am sure we'll continue to work together on different projects. Although she will be stepping down from the county board, Abel will remain in her position as she will maintain her position as Normal Township Supervisor. As the township heads into its next levy season, Abel said there will be conversations about how it can maintain the same level of support through its general assistance program without a higher levy request. The general assistance program offers up to $439 in monthly assistance grants to residents without an adequate income or the resources to provide for basic needs. It is intended for individuals over the age of 18 who do not have minor children in the household and who need help while looking for gainful employment or pursuing a disability decision. Abel said the program assisted about 45 individuals a month in the last few years, but after hiring additional staff trained in social work and general assistance management, the township has been able to cut the number of cases down to 23 as of Wednesday. In the last few fiscal years, Normal Township budgeted between $450,000 and $500,000 in expenditures out of its general assistance fund, compared to between $100,000 and $150,000 in revenues. Abel said this was because of a statutory requirement that a township cannot have a fund reserve that is 2.5 times that fund's annual budget. Probably after next year, if we continue that level without raising the levy, that reserve will be gone, Abel said. Abel said her priorities as supervisor will also include reviewing the township's employee manual and human relations policy via a work group, addressing custodial and maintenance staffing, and drafting both a 10-year preventative maintenance plan and a 5-year capital improvement plan. And this next story is titled, Krishnamurthy Hears from Businesses on Utility Costs, Dateline Bloomington. Windy City Wieners owner Stephen Marifjaren, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, was shocked to see that his latest utility bill, usually around $1,000, was closer to $2,100. This is more than what he said he pays in rent for the Washington Street property that houses his restaurant in downtown Bloomington. As a business owner, your fixed expenses are supposed to be a small percentage of your revenue, he said. If you are projecting 5 to 7%, and now it's 9 to 11%, that's coming out of your bottom line, if you're lucky enough to have a bottom line. He shared his concerns with U.S. Representative Raja Krishnamurthy, Democrat of Schaumburg, who was in Bloomington on Wednesday to hear from small business owners about the impact of rising utility costs that he tied to aging infrastructure and recent federal policy decisions. Krishnamurthy is among the Democrats vying for the party's nomination to succeed longtime U.S. Senator Dick Durbin when he steps down next year. Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton and U.S. Representative Robin Kelly have also launched campaigns for the March 17th primary election. On Wednesday, Krishnamurthy said the loss of tax credits for wind and solar projects led to the cancellation of more than $22 billion in clean energy investments nationwide and threatened 21,000 potential jobs in Illinois. He also used those figures in a letter to the U.S. Department of Energy last month, drawing on analyses from Environmental Entrepreneurs, a national clean energy business group that tracks jobs and investment, and from the University of Illinois Labor and Employment Relations Program. I am not necessarily against having other forms of energy available, Krishnamurthy said, acknowledging the argument for an all-of-the-above approach that mixes renewables, nuclear, and fossil fuels. We should, but if all of the above becomes just some of the above, then guess what? Your electricity bills go up through the roof. Marifjaren said rising utility prices will also affect his other fixed expenses, such as rising fuel costs could affect how much suppliers charge to deliver product. Normal Mayor Chris Coos, who owns Vitesse Cycle Shop, shared similar concerns and said his businesses face higher utility and shipping costs. Ameren, Illinois, recently came under fire for a proposal that would raise natural gas rates $8 to $10 a month per household. The estimated $131 million in revenue from this change would be used to replace and upgrade aging infrastructure. And Nicor Gas, which serves northern and west central Illinois, also seeks to raise its monthly rates by $7.50. Krishnamurthy said utilities may need capital for infrastructure, but with electricity supplies tightening as demand rises, it is not sustainable for bills to keep climbing. We should bring an abundance of energy to the grid, he said. We should modernize the grid, and we should have affordability become a greater factor in people's calculus and their decision-making in the future about what types of rate increases are acceptable in the future. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, October 3rd, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.